and it was because he thought wrongly that the following day was one of confusion, both on the Unimera and in Dr. Darrell's suburban home. It hit Dr. Darrell's home first, in point of time, through the medium of Polly, the maid, whose month's vacation was now quite a thing of the past. She flew down the stairs in a flurry and stutter. The good doctor met her, and she tried vainly to put emotion into words, but ended by thrusting a sheet of paper and a cubical object at him. He took them unwillingly and said, "What's wrong, Polly?"
"She's gone, doctor."
"Who's gone?"
"Arcadia!"
"What do you mean, gone? Gone where? What are you talking about?" And she stamped her foot.
"I don't know. She's gone. And there's a suitcase and some clothes gone with her, and there's that letter. Why don't you read it instead of just standing there? Oh, you man!"
Dr. Darrell shrugged and opened the envelope. The letter was not long, and except for the angular signature, Arcady, was in the ornate and flowering handwriting of Arcadia's transcriber. "Dear Father, it would have been simply too heartbreaking to say goodbye to you in person. I might have cried like a little girl, and you would have been ashamed of me. So I'm writing a letter instead to tell you how much I'll miss you, even while I'm having this perfectly wonderful summer vacation with Uncle Homer. I'll take good care of myself, and it won't be long before I'm home again. Meanwhile, I'm leaving you something that's all my own. You can have it now. Your loving daughter, Arcady." He read it through several times, with an expression that grew blanker each time. He said stiffly, "Have you read this, Polly?" Polly was instantly on the defensive.
"I certainly can't be blamed for that, doctor. The envelope has Polly written on the outside, and I had no way of telling there was a letter for you on the inside. I'm no snoop, doctor, and in the years I've been with..."
Darrell held up a placating hand. "Very well, Polly. It's not important. I just wanted to make sure you understood what had happened." He was considering rapidly. It was no use telling her to forget the matter. With regard to the enemy, forget was a meaningless word. And the advice, insofar as it made the matter more important, would have had the opposite effect. He said instead, "She's a queer little girl, you know. Very romantic. Ever since we arranged to have her go off on a space trip this summer, she's been quite excited."
"And just why has no one told me about this space trip?"
"It was arranged while you were away, and we forgot. It's nothing more complicated than that." Polly's original emotions now concentrated themselves into a single, overwhelming indignation.
"Simple, is it? The poor chick has gone off with one suitcase, without a decent stitch of clothes to her, and alone at that. How long will she be away?"
"Now, I won't have you worrying about it, Polly. There will be plenty of clothes for her on the ship. It's been all arranged. Will you tell Mr. Anthor that I want to see him? Oh, and first, is this the object that Arcadia has left for me?" He turned it over in his hand. Polly tossed her head.
"I'm sure I don't know. The letter was on top of it, and that's every bit I can tell you."
"Forget to tell me, indeed. If her mother were alive..." Darrell waved her away. "Please call Mr. Anthor." Anthor's viewpoint on the matter differed radically from that of Arcadia's father. He punctuated his initial remarks with clenched fists and torn hair, and from there passed on to bitterness.
"Great space, what are you waiting for? What are we both waiting for? Get the spaceport on the viewer and have them contact the Unimera."
"Softly, Peleus. She's my daughter."
"It's not your galaxy."
"Now wait. She's an intelligent girl, Peleus, and she's thought this thing out carefully. We had better follow her thoughts while this thing is fresh. Do you know what this thing is?"
"No. Why should it matter what it is?"
"Because it's a sound receiver."
"That thing?
It's homemade, but it will work. I've tested it. Don't you see? It's her way of telling us that she's been a party to our conversations of policy. She knows where Homer Munn is going and why. She's decided it would be exciting to go along."
"Oh, great space," groaned the younger man. "Another mine for the Second Foundation to pick."
"Except that there's no reason why the Second Foundation should, a priori, suspect a 14-year-old girl of being a danger. Unless we do anything to attract attention to her, such as calling back a ship out of space for no reason other than to take her off. Do you forget whom we're dealing with? How narrow the margin is that separates us from discovery? How helpless we are thereafter? But we can't have everything depend on an insane child. She's not insane, and we have no choice. She need not have written the letter, but she did it to keep us from going to the police after a lost child.
Her letter suggests that we convert the entire matter into a friendly offer on the part of Munn to take an old friend's daughter off for a short vacation. And why not? He's been my friend for nearly 20 years. He's known her since she was 3 when I brought her back from Trantor. It's a perfectly natural thing, and in fact, ought to decrease suspicion. A spy does not carry a 14-year-old niece about with him. So, and what will Munn do when he finds her? Dr. Darrell heaved his eyebrows once. I can't say, but I presume she'll handle him. But the house was somehow very lonely at night, and Dr. Darrell found that the fate of the galaxy made remarkably little difference while his daughter's mad little life was in danger. The excitement on the Unimera, if involving fewer people, was considerably more intense. In the luggage compartment, Arcadia found herself, in the first place, aided by experience, and in the second, hampered by the reverse. Thus she met the initial acceleration with equanimity, and the more subtle nausea that accompanied the inside-outness of the first jump through hyperspace with stoicism. Both had been experienced on space hops before, and she was tensed for them. She knew also that luggage compartments were included in the ship's ventilation system, and that they could even be bathed in wall light. This last, however, she excluded as being too unconscionably unromantic. She remained in the dark, as a conspirator should, breathing very softly, and listening to the little miscellany of noises that surrounded Homer Munn. They were undistinguished noises, the kind made by a man alone. The shuffling of shoes, the rustle of fabric against metal, the soughing of an upholstered chair seat retreating under weight, the sharp click of a control unit, or the soft slap of a palm over a photoelectric cell. Yet eventually it was the lack of experience that caught up with Arcadia. In the book films and on the videos, the stowaway seemed to have such an infinite capacity for obscurity. Of course, there was always the danger of dislodging something which would fall with a crash, or of sneezing. In videos, you were almost sure to sneeze. It was an accepted matter. She knew all this, and was careful. There was also the realization that thirst and hunger might be encountered. For this, she was prepared with ration cans out of the pantry. But yet things remained that the films never mentioned, and it dawned upon Arcadia with a shock that, despite the best intentions in the world, she could stay hidden in the closet for only a limited time. And on a one-man sports cruiser, such as the Unimera, living space consisted, essentially, of a single room, so that there wasn't even the risky possibility of sneaking out of the compartment while Munn was engaged somewhere else. She waited frantically for the sounds of sleep to arise. If only she knew whether he snored. At least she knew where the bunk was, and she could recognize the rolling protest of one when she heard it. There was a long breath, and then a yawn. She waited through a gathering silence, punctuated by the bunk's soft protest against a changed position or a shifted leg. The door of the luggage compartment opened easily at the pressure of her finger, and her craning neck. There was a definite human sound that broke off sharply. Arcadia solidified. Silence. Still silence. She tried to poke her eyes outside the door without moving her head, and failed. The head followed the eyes. Homer Munn was awake, of course, reading in bed, bathed in the soft, unspreading bedlight, staring into the darkness with wide eyes, and groping one hand stealthily under the pillow. Arcadia's head moved sharply back on itself. Then the light went out entirely, and Munn's voice said with shaky sharpness, "I've got a blaster, and I'm shooting by the galaxy." And Arcadia wailed, "It's only me, don't shoot!" Remarkable what a fragile flower romance is. A gun with a nervous operator behind it can spoil the whole thing. The light was back on, all over the ship, and Munn was sitting up in bed, the somewhat grizzled hair on his thin chest, and the sparse one-day growth on his chin, lent him an entirely fallacious appearance of disreputability. Arcadia stepped out, yanking at her Medellin jacket, which was supposed to be guaranteed wrinkle-proof. After a wild moment in which he almost jumped out of bed, but remembered, and instead yanked the sheet up to his shoulders, Munn gargled, "What?" He was completely incomprehensible. Arcadia said meekly, "Would you excuse me for a minute? I've got to go wash my hands." She knew the geography of the vessel and slipped away quickly. When she returned, with her courage oozing back, Homer Munn was standing before her with a faded bathrobe on the outside and a brilliant fury on the inside. What the black holes of space are you doing aboard this ship? How did you get here? What do you think I'm supposed to do with you? What's going on here? He might have asked questions indefinitely, but Arcadia interrupted sweetly. I just wanted to come along, Uncle Homer. Why? I'm not going anywhere. You're going to Calgan for information about the Second Foundation. And Mun let out a wild howl and collapsed completely. For one horrified moment, Arcadia thought he would have hysterics or beat his head against the wall. He was still holding the blaster, and her stomach grew ice cold as she watched it. Watch out, take it easy, was all she could think of to say. But he struggled back to relative normality and threw the blaster onto the bunk with a force that should have set it off and blown a hole through the ship's hull. How did you get on? He asked slowly, as though gripping each word with his teeth very carefully to prevent it from trembling before letting it out. It was easy. I just came into the hangar with my suitcase and said, Mr. Munn's baggage, and the man in charge just waved his thumb without even looking up. I'll have to take you back, you know, said Homer. And there was a sudden wild glee within him at the thought. By space, this wasn't his fault. You can't, said Arcadia calmly. It would attract attention. What? You know, the whole purpose of your going to Calgan was because it was natural for you to go and ask permission to look into the mule's records. And you've got to be natural so that you attract no attention at all. If you go back with a girl stowaway, it might even get into the telenews reports. Where did you get those notions about Calgan? These are childish... He was far too flippant for conviction, of course, even to one who knew less than did Arcadia. I heard, she couldn't avoid pride completely, with a sound recorder. I know all about it, so you've got to let me come along. What about your father? He played a quick trump. For all he knows, you're kidnapped, dead. I left a note, she said, over-trumping, and he probably knows he mustn't make a fuss or anything. You'll probably get a spacegram from him. To Mun, the only explanation was sorcery, because the receiving signal sounded wildly 2 seconds after she finished. She said, That's my father, I bet. And it was. The message wasn't long, and it was addressed to Arcadia. It said, Thank you for your lovely present, which I'm sure you put to good use. Have a good time. You see, she said, That's instructions. Homer grew used to her. After a while, he was glad she was there. Eventually, he wondered how he would have made it without her. She prattled, she was excited. Most of all, she was completely unconcerned. She knew the Second Foundation was the enemy, yet it didn't bother her. She knew that on Calgan, he was to deal with a hostile officialdom, but she could hardly wait. Maybe it came of being 14. At any rate, the week-long trip now meant conversation rather than introspection. To be sure, it wasn't a very enlightening conversation, since it concerned, almost entirely, the girl's notions on the subject of how best to treat the Lord of Calgan. Amusing and nonsensical, and yet delivered with weighty deliberation. Homer found himself actually capable of smiling, as he listened and wondered out of just which gem of historical fiction she got her twisted notion of the great universe. It was the evening before the last jump. Calgan was a bright star in the scarcely twinkling emptiness of the outer reaches of the galaxy. The ship's telescope made it a sparkling blob of barely perceptible diameter. Arcadia sat cross-legged in the good chair. She was wearing a pair of slacks and a none-too-roomy shirt that belonged to Homer. Her own more feminine wardrobe had been washed and ironed for the landing. She said, I'm going to write historical novels, you know. She was quite happy about the trip. Uncle Homer didn't the least mind listening to her, and it made conversation so much more pleasant when you could talk to a really intelligent person who was serious about what you said. She continued, I've read books and books about all the great men of Foundation history. You know, like Selden, Hardin, Mallow, Devers, and all the rest. I've even read most of what you've written about the mule, except that it isn't much fun to read those parts where the Foundation loses. Wouldn't you rather read a history where they skipped all the silly, tragic parts? Yes, I would, Mun assured her gravely. But it wouldn't be a fair history, would it, Arcady? You'd never get academic respect unless you give the whole story. Oh, pooh, who cares about academic respect? She found him delightful. He hadn't missed calling her Arcady for days. My novels are going to be interesting and are going to sell and be famous. What's the use of writing books unless you sell them and become well known? I don't want just some old professors to know me. It's got to be everybody. Her eyes darkened with pleasure at the thought, and she wriggled into a more comfortable position. In fact, as soon as I can get Father to let me, I'm going to visit Trantor, so as I can get background material on the First Empire, you know? I was born on Trantor, did you know that? He did, but he said, "You were," and put just the right amount of amazement into his voice. He was rewarded with something between a beam and a simper. Uh-huh. My grandmother, you know, Beta Daryl, you've heard of her, was on Trantor once with my grandfather. In fact, that's where they stopped the mule, when all the galaxy was at his feet. And my father and mother went there also when they were first married. I was born there. I even lived there till Mother died. Only I was just 3 then, and I don't remember much about it. Were you ever on Trantor, Uncle Homer? No, can't say I was. He leaned back against the cold bulkhead and listened idly. Calgan was very close, and he felt his uneasiness flooding back. Isn't it just the most romantic world? My father says that under Stanel the Fifth, it had more people than any 10 worlds nowadays. He says that it was just one big world of metals, one big city that was the capital of all the galaxy. He's shown me pictures that he took on Trantor. It's all in ruins now, but it's still stupendous. I just love to see it again. In fact, Homer. Yes? Why don't we go there when we've finished with Calgan? Some of the fright hurtled back into his face. What? Now, don't start on that. This is business, not pleasure. Remember that. But it is business, she squeaked. There might be incredible amounts of information on Trantor. Don't you think so? No, I don't. He scrambled to his feet. Now untangle yourself from the computer. We've got to make the last jump, and then you turn in. One good thing about landing, anyway. He was about fed up with trying to sleep on an overcoat on the metal floor. The calculations were not difficult. The Space Route Handbook was quite explicit on the Foundation Calgan route. There was the momentary twitch of the timeless passage through hyperspace, and the final light year dropped away. The sun of Calgan was a sun now, large, bright, and yellow-white, invisible behind the portholes that had automatically closed on the sunlit side. Calgan was only a night's sleep away. Chapter 12. Lord. Of all the worlds on the galaxy, Calgan undoubtedly had the most unique history. That of the planet Terminus, for instance, was that of an almost uninterrupted rise. That of Trantor, once capital of the galaxy, was that of an almost uninterrupted fall. But Calgan... Calgan first gained fame as the pleasure world of the galaxy, 2 centuries before the birth of Harry Seldon. It was a pleasure world in the sense that it made an industry, and an immensely profitable one at that, out of amusement. And it was a stable industry. It was the most stable industry in the galaxy. When all the galaxy perished as a civilization, little by little, scarcely a feather's weight of catastrophe fell upon Calgan. No matter how the economy and sociology of the neighboring sectors of the galaxy changed, there was always an elite. And it is always the characteristic of an elite that it possesses leisure as the great reward of its elitehood. Calgan was at the service, therefore, successively and successfully, of the effete and perfumed dandies of the imperial court, with their sparkling and libidinous ladies, of the rough and raucous warlords, who ruled in iron the worlds they had gained in blood, with their unbridled and lascivious wenches, of the plump and luxurious businessmen of the Foundation, with their lush and flagitious mistresses. It was quite undiscriminating, since they all had money, and since Calgan serviced all and barred none, since its commodity was in unfailing demand, since it had the wisdom to interfere in no world's politics, to stand on no one's legitimacy. It prospered when nothing else did, and remained fat when all grew thin. That is, until the mule. Then, somehow, it fell too, before a conqueror who was impervious to amusement, or to anything but conquest. To him, all planets were alike, even Calgan. So, for a decade, Calgan found itself in the strange role of galactic metropolis, mistress of the greatest empire since the end of the galactic empire itself. And then, with the death of the mule, as sudden as the zoom, came the drop. The Foundation broke away,
with it and after it, much of the rest of the mule's dominions. 50 years later, there was left only the bewildering memory of that short space of power, like an opium dream. Calgan never quite recovered. It could never return to the unconcerned pleasure world it had been, for the spell of power never quite releases its hold. It lived instead under a succession of men whom the Foundation called the Lords of Calgan, but who styled themselves First Citizen of the Galaxy, in imitation of the Mule's only title, and who maintained the fiction that they were conquerors too. The current Lord of Calgan had held that position for 5 months. He had gained it originally by virtue of his position at the head of the Calganian Navy, and through a lamentable lack of caution on the part of the previous Lord. Yet no one on Calgan was quite stupid enough to go into the question of legitimacy too long or too closely. These things happened, and are best accepted. Yet that sort of survival of the fittest, in addition to putting a premium on bloodiness and evil, occasionally allowed capability to come to the fore as well. Lord Stettin was competent enough, and not easy to manage. Not easy for His Eminence the First Minister, who, with fine impartiality, had served the last Lord as well as the present, and who would, if he lived long enough, serve the next as honestly. Nor easy for Lady Calia, who was Stettin's more than friend, yet less than wife. In Lord Stettin's private apartments, the three were alone that evening. The First Citizen, bulky and glistening in the Admiral's uniform that he affected, scowled out from the unupholstered chair, in which he sat as stiffly as the plastic of which it was composed. His First Minister, Lev Mirus, faced him with a far-off unconcern, his long, nervous fingers stroking absently and rhythmically the deep line that curved from hooked nose along gaunt and sunken cheek to the point nearly of the gray-bearded chin. The Lady Calia disposed of herself gracefully on the deeply furred covering of a fomite couch, her full lips trembling a bit in an unheeded pout. "Sir," said Mirus. It was the only title adhering to a lord who was styled only First Citizen. "You lack a certain view of the continuity of history. Your own life, with its tremendous revolutions, leads you to think of the course of civilization as something equally amenable to sudden change. But it is not. The mule showed otherwise. But who can follow in his footsteps? He was more than a man, remember. And he, too, was not entirely successful." "Poochie," whimpered the Lady Calia, suddenly, and then shrank into herself at the furious gesture from the First Citizen. Lord Stettin said harshly, "Do not interrupt, Calia. Mirus, I am tired of inaction. My predecessor spent his life polishing the Navy into a finely turned instrument that has not its equal in the galaxy. And he died with the magnificent machine lying idle. Am I to continue that? I, an admiral of the Navy? How long before the machine rusts? At present, it is a drain on the treasury and returns nothing. Its officers long for dominion, its men for loot. All Calgan desires the return of empire and glory. Are you capable of understanding that? These are but words that you use, but I grasp your meaning. Dominion, loot, glory, pleasant when they are obtained. But the process of obtaining them is often risky and always unpleasant. The first fine flush may not last, and in all history it has never been wise to attack the Foundation. Even the mule would have been wiser to refrain." There were tears in the Lady Calia's blue, empty eyes. Of late, Poochie scarcely saw her, and now, when he had promised the evening to her, this horrible, gray, thin man, who always looked through her rather than at her, had forced his way in. And Poochie let him. She dared not say anything, was frightened even of the sob that forced its way out. But Stettin was speaking now in the voice she hated, hard and impatient. He was saying, "You're a slave to the far past. The Foundation is greater in volume and population, but they are loosely knit and will fall apart at a blow. What holds them together these days is merely inertia. An inertia I am strong enough to smash. You are hypnotized by the old days, when only the Foundation had atomic power. They were able to dodge the last hammer blows of the dying empire, and then faced only with the unbrained anarchy of the warlords, who would counter the Foundation's atomic vessels only with hulks and relics. But the mule, my dear Mirus, has changed that. He spread the knowledge that the Foundation had hoarded to itself,
through half the galaxy, and the monopoly in science is gone forever. We can match them.
And the second foundation? Questioned Miris coolly.
And the second foundation, replied Stettin as coolly. Do you know its intentions? It took 10 years to stop the mule, if indeed it was the factor which some doubt. Are you unaware that a good many of the Foundation psychologists and sociologists are of the opinion that the Selden plan has been completely disrupted since the days of the mule? If the plan has gone, then a vacuum exists which I may fill as well as the next man. Our knowledge of these matters is not great enough to warrant the gamble. Our knowledge, perhaps. But we have a Foundation visitor on the planet. Did you know that? A Homer Munn, who I understand has written articles on the mule, and has expressed exactly that opinion, that the Selden plan no longer exists. The First Minister nodded. I have heard of him, or at least of his writings. What does he desire? He asks permission to enter the mule's palace. Indeed, it would be wise to refuse. It is never advisable to disturb the superstitions with which a planet is held. I will consider that, and we will speak again. Miris bowed himself out. Lady Kalia said tearfully,
Are you angry with me, Poochie?
Stettin turned on her savagely.
Have I not told you before never to call me by that ridiculous name in the presence of others?
You used to like it.
Well, I don't anymore, and it is not to happen again.
He stared at her darkly. It was a mystery to him that he tolerated her these days. She was a soft, empty-headed thing, comfortable to the touch, with a pliable affection that was a convenient facet to a hard life. Yet even that affection was becoming wearisome. She dreamed of marriage, of being first lady. Ridiculous. She was all very well when he had been an admiral only, but now as first citizen and future conqueror, he needed more. He needed heirs who could unite his future dominions, something the mule had never had, which was why his empire did not survive his strange non-human life. He, Stettin, needed someone of the great historic families of the Foundation with whom he could fuse dynasties. He wondered testily why he did not rid himself of Kalia now. It would be no trouble. She would whine a bit. He dismissed the thought. She had her points, occasionally. Kalia was cheering up now. The influence of Greybeard was gone, and her Poochie's granite face was softening now. She lifted herself in a single fluid motion and melted toward him.
You're not going to scold me, are you?
No. He patted her absently. Now just sit quietly for a while, will you? I want to think.
About the man from the Foundation?
Yes.
Poochie.
This was a pause. What?
Poochie, the man has a little girl with him, you said, remember? Could I see her when she comes?
Now what do you think I want him to bring his brat with him for? Is my audience room to be a grammar school? Enough of your nonsense, Kalia.
But I'll take care of her, Poochie. You won't even have to bother with her. It's just that I hardly ever see children, and you know how I love them.
He looked at her sardonically. She never tired of this approach. She loved children, i.e. his children, i.e. his legitimate children, i.e. marriage. He laughed. This particular little piece, he said, is a great girl of 14 or 15. She's probably as tall as you are. Kalia looked crushed.
Well, could I anyway? She could tell me about the Foundation. I've always wanted to go there, you know. My grandfather was a Foundation man. Won't you take me there sometime, Poochie?
Stettin smiled at the thought. Perhaps he would, as conqueror. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.